Will you please join me in the Serenity Prayer? God, all right, tonight our 40-minute speaker is Ty from Century City. Welcome.
My name is Ty. I'm an alcoholic. I've been told that I'm supposed to stand right in the middle of these mics and speak, right in between them. So I'm going to be really conscientious of that. Well, there's a lot going on here. I want to thank Kathleen for asking me to do this. It's an honor and privilege to participate in the meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous. And you'll find out in the next 40 minutes, I'm really grateful. I got here a little early, and I was able to talk to some of the outside, and that's I got to tell you, that's a big highlight of Alcoholics Anonymous for me. And it's been my experience through all my years in Alcoholics Anonymous, but one drug talking to another is where the miracle lies. We start to find out, we start formulate, we did the same things, and maybe we just did a little different. But it's that one drunk talking to another, and it's that relating to theism, which is our common bond. And for years and years, I chased this program, Alcoholics Anonymous, and couldn't get it until I finally realized that. I know this is a good meeting because, there they go. I know. I have a tendency to speak very, very quietly. So I'll try to bring my volume up. But I came in and I knew this was a really good meeting because all the chairs match. I left Santa Monica today at 4:30, and... I wish you could have been there with me because I gave two talks driving up. I gave the talk from Santa Monica to where the 405 meets the 5. Where the 5 and the 405 meet, that was just more people joining the second meeting because I was so good, they wanted me to do it again. I got to tell you, I was in my talk and during my talk, and about halfway through, I looked out and there was a couple of tears and there was a few oohs and ahs, anyway, I hope I can repeat. I always felt. I always felt kind of less than. I know that's kind of a shock to most of you, but I didn't feel like I just didn't feel like everybody else. I was born in Compton. I was raised in Compton. It was very quickly. I had difficulty in school. It was the second grade. The teacher was named Miss Champion. The classroom was like any other classroom. It was rows and rows, of children sitting there, all attentive on the first day of school. And the teacher went up and down the aisles. And she asked our names. And Dave said, my name's Dave. And then Judy. And then Mary, and I started tensing up. I started, something inside me just started tensing up. And then it came up to me, And the teacher said, I know Ty. Ty was here last year. And I don't say that, make you know, myself, you know, full less than. But I tell you at that moment, that's the way I felt. And, you know, and what I did with that feeling is I just stuffed it. You know, I just stuffed it. And I learned to do that very well. Just one more. You know, some people talk about the spring getting tightened and getting tightened. For me, I just kind of stuffed it up, just kind of ignored it. And I'll do that for a long time. I was diagnosed with severe dyslexia to the point where I couldn't read or write. And I was just kind of put along in the grades, you know, just kind of thrown through, and except the second, you know, whew, you know, we'll do this one again. And I was just passed through the system. I wasn't very good in sports, you know, and, you know, it's you know, it's embarrassing to say even today, but you know, I wasn't very good in sports at all. I was the classic, you know, nobody wanted me on their team. I was overweight. I wasn't very coordinated. And I would stand there and we'd pick the teams, and you know, day after day after day after day, you know, nobody wanted me on their team, and I'd be standing there all by myself, and, you know, and I just sucked it up one more time. And the PE coach, you know, a guy named Mr. Berg, you know, and there was Mr. Patterson, you know, they would say, you know, just come with me and help, you know, just catalog stuff and do some paperwork and stuff like that. You know, I'm really grateful to those two guys because they didn't make a big deal about it. You know, they didn't say, you know, nobody wants you. You know, you're a loser. They didn't. They just kind of ignored it. Just kind of said, you know, come and hang out and help us catalog some stuff. You know, that was a long time ago. I'm grateful for those guys. I will soon, very soon, discover alcohol. And alcohol saved my life at that time. Because alcohol allowed me to do things that I couldn't possibly ever do to get back at you. Just like any other budding entrepreneur and somebody that didn't feel like they really fit in, you know, I had a lot of time on my hands, you know, and so I was talking to Stan here before the meeting, you know, and I, you know, we were living in Downey at the time. We finally, you know, made ourselves out of the hood into Downey. And my parents had a little beach house at the corner of Dover Drive and PCH, a little trailer park behind Dover Liquor, Will Wright's Ice Cream Parlor, and Ed's Tackle. And I worked at all three of those places because I had nothing else to do. You know, the kids really wanted to hang out with me because, you know, I was a little different. There soon afterwards, you know, my parents put me in a special school. And I got to tell you, you know, I took the classic short bus to school. I'd walk out back of our property, and my bus stop was right outside the gate. And and your bus stop, or the normal kids' bus stop, was down the street. And as I was standing there on my bus stop, I could see you standing down at your bus stop. And I would stand there, and I would just pray that my bus would come first. Because if my bus came first, everything's just fine. But if your bus came first and you came by, you would no doubt hang out the window and point at me and say, there's Ty, he's retarded. You know, and I just would, again, just suck it up. I would come home from school and I would find my mom, you know, crying, sitting there at the kitchen table. Unbeknownst to me, the reason she was crying is because, you know, kids were teasing her only son as he was walking home from school. You know, I'm really grateful for that mom because, you know, she sat with me every day and taught me how to read and write. I had my first drink when I was 15 years old. I scored some beer for some guys from the high school. They said, aren't you Ty, the guy that is in one of those classes? And I said, yes, I am. And they go, can you get us some beer? And I said, yes, I can. And I walked out from the back of that liquor store at Dover, had a little back room, and I saw the look on their faces, and I saw that I had instant friends. And it changed everything. And when I got, and it wasn't too long after that, a couple days later, I got drunk, and I told what I thought of you. And people stayed away from me, And over the summer, you know, I thinned out and I started, you know, formulating myself a little bit better. And people, you know, started gravitating towards me. Because, you know, I carved this whole persona. You know, I was pretty much a really tough guy. In some cases, I was. You know, I like to think of myself as a rebel and a loner and a rebel. And, you know, it worked for me for a while. You know, I wish I could tell you that the drinking kind of worked, but, you know, the drinking turned on me really quick. I was a blackout drinker. I like to call it time travel. My territory was the 405 freeway, you know. Pretty much every jail you can possibly think of off the 405 freeway I've been in. Somehow my first drunk driving offense was in Laguna Beach, and it was Laguna Canyon Road, and they took me to jail. And I woke up in the morning, and, you know, I had really long hair at the time, and my hair was all matted, and, you know, it's a combination of, you know, sleep, saliva, beer, and who knows what else, you know, and my hair was all kind of matted, and I had that, you know, that taste in your mouth, and, you know, and they put the styrofoam, believe it or not, they had styrofoam, this is 40 years ago, wow, and they put the styrofoam box, you know, in the jail cell, in his pancakes, you know, I open it up, and the butter was just, you know, it was just like, it was rock solid, and, you know, and I got this plastic knife, and or fork, or spoon, I don't know, and I'm trying to spread the butter, and, you know, it's just not working, you know, and then the syrup was all cold, and the pancakes were cold, and everything was cold, so, you know, Laguna Beach Police Department was really unique in that, you know, the court's right there. And I remember, you know, being drugged into the old courtroom right there, and this is my first arrest, so this is kind of a big deal. So my parents were in the gallery there, and I noticed the shame on their faces, which wasn't cool. And then the judge asked me to approach the bench, and, you know, asked me how I pleaded. You know, I proceeded to tell them about the butter that didn't melt and how I thought it was an atrocity. You know. And how a nice place like Laguna Beach could be a part of such a thing. And I then went back to the jail cell and led this huge butter rebellion. It's known as the Butter Rebellion of 68. So, you know, that would be beginning of 28 arrests. 14 plus drunk drivings. I just heard somebody say, "Damn!" You know, I like to drink and drive, and because there's always a party someplace else, there was always something better someplace else, and that's hence get in the car and try to find it or go there. I wasn't uncommon for me to start drinking in Pasadena, this place called Handlebar Saloon on Colorado Boulevard, and end up under the pier. In Ocean Beach, San Diego, and not know how I got there. Now, those of you know that, you know, that's a lot of freeways, and especially the 110 is the oldest freeway in the country, and it's also the narrowest. And how I negotiated that down to the 5, and et cetera, et cetera. I have no idea this very day. But that's how I drank. And I would just rack up these drunk drivings. One after another. You know, it never started out to be that way. You know, I just wanted to kind of feel. I just wanted to numb. I just wanted to numb myself so I don't have to have the feelings that I felt all my life. I drank because I couldn't do. I couldn't be by myself. I couldn't be in my own shoes. I couldn't be who I was and what it was, the life that was dealt me. That and the fact that I had alcoholism. You know, I can't tell you how many times I tried. I tried just to have a few, just to take the edge off and just kind of feel, just a little tinge of a buzz, and I never came close. I always, every time, always overshot it. I never came close to drinking like a normal person. I had every intention of, well, my friends would call me and say, you know, we're going to the Rusty Pelican on PCH, and we're going to have a, you know, some, we're going to have some, you know, some steamed clams and some clam chowder, stuff like that, and you know, and that's all I wanted to do, just have a couple beers. And what inevitably always happened, it would be 4 o'clock in the afternoon, and they'd be saying things like, "Wow, you know, it's time to go home because I got to be at work tomorrow," you know. And what always happened to me, it would be 1:30 in the evening, and I'd be pounding my hand on the fist, asking, "Just please, one more, just one more." What happened to me generally is, you know, is the next morning I would try to put together a series of what happened the night before, and I would call somebody up, and there would be that dead silence on the phone. Always followed up by the following words saying, "I can't believe you're calling here today. Do you have any idea what you did?" December, you know, 1983, I appeared in front of a judge one more time, you know. Now, I want you to know that, you know, I had so many cases in the state of California, they pretty much overlapped. And, you know, at any given time, pretty much doing math, but, you know, I had 3 or 4 cases going at one time. So I was on a constant court card, and I was always on probation. For me, going down, you know, to see my probation officer was just, you know, like going to a tie flying class, you know. It was just something I did on a regular basis. I also was sent to my first meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous when I was 16 years old. I remember the place. It was in a women's club. It wasn't a women's meeting. It was a mixed meeting. It was at noon. It was in Corona Del Mar. And I remember walking in there, and I remember being made to feel welcome. And I listened to what people were saying, and at that point, I could honestly tell you I could relate, but I wasn't ready. I was in a court car from that time, from the time I was 16 till that time I was 28 years old. I was in a constant court car. They just overlapped and overlapped and overlapped. And I went to meetings. I went to meetings all over the place. I went to meetings in Newport. I went to meetings at Orange Olive Club, I think it was called, Orange something in Santa Ana. I mean, I went all over the place. Went to Laguna, you know. But I could never get any time together. I couldn't get any time together because I wasn't ready. And I would just go out and get more drunk drivings. And I'd just go do more jail. I did 3 years total in jail. Did 9 months, did another 10 months, then did another like 11 months. I did numerous 20 days and 15 weeks. But you know, this December 1983, you know, I had to go appear in front of a judge one more time, just to give him my update. So I went to my probation officer first, you know, and he said, you know, you got to appear in front of the judge. And I said, okay, no problem. And I was pretty hungover that day. And I thought maybe they're just going to violate me right here and there, because I still had a lot of booze in my system from the night before. I think I got like 2 or 3 hours sleep, and I went right to the probation. And I appeared in front of that judge, and the judge, you know, he had my file there. And he says, he asked me if I was still going to those meetings of Alcoholics Anonymous. And I looked at him and I said, "Yes, Your Honor." And he said something I'll never forget. He says, "There's really nice people in those meetings, aren't there?" I said, "Yes, Your Honor, there is." Because that's been my experience. And he asked me to approach the branch, and I did. And he had my file there. And he goes, "You know, here in your file on page 1, it says you're a habitual alcoholic. And the state of California feels you're not even rehabilitatable. State of California has given up on you. He goes, but I haven't. He asked me what I thought about that. I said, I didn't feel too good about it. He just told me to keep on going to those meetings. You'll see me again. There was something about that. It won't be too long after that, on January 10th, 1984, I had my last drink. I was having a hard time getting where I wanted to get, what I talked about before in the blackout. I couldn't black out. It just, there's something was going on. I couldn't drink enough, and I couldn't get to where I wanted to get. I don't remember a lot about that night, though. I remember when I was drinking, I couldn't sleep very well, and I would toss and turn, and I could get just a couple hours, or if I was blacked out, then I would just black out. But those weren't happening, and I was having a hard time sleeping for the past couple months. And on January 10th, 1984, something clearly happened. I slept. I slept for the first time in a long, long, long time. And I woke up the next morning and I felt clear-eyed and I felt different. You know, and I called this guy up in Los Angeles because I was living down in Palm Springs at the time, and you know, I couldn't use the words, you know, if I come up there, can you help me? I use the words, if I come up there, can you handle me, you know? Because, you know, I still thought I was kind of a tough guy. And he says, yeah, come on up, you know. And I met him at this place called Ohio Street, you know. And, you know, I started going to meetings. You know, and I was in charge of cleaning the floor. After a week or so, you know, and which I thought was really stupid. It was really lame, you know. But, you know, I would look forward to that every week. I would move those benches. There were benches back then. I would pull those benches out of the way, you know, and I'd mop like crazy. You know, and it was through that mop that, you know, I started finding myself. I started holding my head up a little higher, and I started, you know, feeling a little better about myself. As crazy as that sounds. And it's always been that way ever since. You know, and I didn't have the skill set, and I didn't have the social ease that so many people have. And I would mop like crazy and try to get done, because outside you'd be pairing up to go have coffee or go to the movies or go get something to eat. You know, and I wanted that. See, that represented normalcy to me. That represented, you know, mainstream. But it was something very foreign to me, because I don't have the social, you know, graces that you did. And, you know, when I would stand out there and you'd come up to me and go, hey, we're going to go eat something to eat. Would you like to come with us? And I'd tell you, no, I'm not going to go. I got better things to do. You know, so I wouldn't go. And I'd go home to my old one-bedroom $69 a month little motel room down in Santa Monica, where there's other guys staying there, and I just hang out by myself and read the big book. But after a while, you know, I trusted you enough to start hanging out with you. Little by little, you know. I felt a little more at ease. I got a sponsor and I worked the steps. You know, I did that inventory. I read it to him. I started doing all the conventions, all the commitments. And I started feeling a little better. About a year of sobriety, I started a career. And, you know, ever since then, it's gotten better and better and better. When I was 7 years sober, my dad came to visit me and told me my mom was dying. And I was able to hang out with her. I was living in Miami at the time, and I'd fly back and forth on the weekends just to hang out with her. It was told to me that, you know, we add to somebody's life. through all my sobriety, you know, I hurt these parents deeply. You know, my when I was drinking, I would find my mom up. My parents split up. We moved into a little apartment in La Habra. My mom worked at a medical records place, the hospital. She was, from what I can get from piecing it together, that, you know, doctors, you know, don't have the best temperament, and they took out a lot of their frustration on my mom and other people too. And it was a tough job for her, but, you know, she would work like 10 hours a day when I was in high school. My dad was gone just so I could, so we could have a place to live. You know, she gave me the bedroom. My mom slept in the living room. We had like a pull-out couch. Grown woman, you know, sleeping in the living room. Her son had the bedroom because I was a selfish taker, you know. And then, you know, I topped it off by getting as much trouble as I did. So I'd come home at night and she'd be up. As soon as she saw that, you know, I was in one piece, and I'd be standing there, you know, staggering back and forth, reeking of booze, she'd go to bed because she knew I was safe that night. You know, I put her through hell. So, you know, when I got sober, you know, I said, how can I possibly begin to make amends to these two wonderful people that want nothing but the best of me? You know, I was told that a simple, you know, I'm sorry, is not going to cut it, because how many times have I done that? So I had to do it by example. And I did that by example by asking them, calling them up and asking them how they are just before they split up and what I could do for them. You know, and that amends was made in years and years and years by adding to their life. Never once did I ever ask them. My mom was around for, I think it was 10 years of my sobriety. No, longer than that, 15 years of my sobriety. I never once asked her for anything. I just gave to her. You know, and when my mom left, you know, the hospice carers came to me and said, you know what your mom talked about a lot? I said, no, what? She was, how grateful she was to Alcoholics Anonymous. For giving their son back. I think that's pretty cool. You know, you know, I'm never going to get an A in Alcoholics Anonymous. But I can't tell you how grateful I am to all of you. You've always, every meeting I went to when I was out, even when I was drinking, you always welcomed me, no matter what. You always had a seat for me. No matter what. You always showed me where the coffee was. You always made me feel welcome. Every time I went to a meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous, no matter where, you'd always come across the room, and you'd always put your hand out, and you'd always say, welcome. I remember every one of you. It's been, you know, it's been a huge honor to hang out with you all for all these years. You know, when I came in, when I stopped drinking, I wasn't the most cordial person, to put it lightly. I had a lot of anger. I had a lot of stuff going on, and I wasn't really ready to work or do anything, but I did the best I could right away. I started waxing cars, and, you know, I waxed a lot of cars that didn't need it. You also, you trusted me to go into your apartment and paint your apartment while you were at work. I painted a lot of apartments that didn't need it. I shook a lot of hands, it'd be $5 and $10 in those sometimes. And you never asked for it back. You would call me up or you'd come up to me in a meeting and say, "What are you doing?" I'd say, "Nothing." "Oh, come on with me," and you go buy me dinner. You know, if nothing else ever happens in my life, it's just been an honor to hang out and stand next to you all for all these years. Everything I had today is a direct result of Alcoholics Anonymous. Everything I learned here is a direct result of Alcoholics Anonymous and watching you and watching how you've done it. 2 years ago on January 18th, I was at the Men's Stag in Hermosa Beach. I got a call that, you know, is it right at 10 o'clock and the meeting was over. It's an hour and a half meeting. It starts at 8:30. There's no break. It's a tough meeting. And the meeting's over at 10 o'clock, and I got a call from my dad's wife that he was in the hospital, and things weren't good. And he was out at Arrowhead Trauma Center. He fell, and they airlifted him there. She doesn't really drive at night, so she couldn't be there. The doctors had a lot of questions that I only have the answers, which I don't really have the answers, but, you know, I'm the only person, you know. And I went to my grand sponsor, Jay. And I said, "Jay, you know," because my sponsor is out of town. I said, "This has happened. This happened. I don't want to go." He goes, "No." He goes, "Yeah, I understand." He goes, "Just call me when you're halfway there." I go, "Jay, maybe you're not understanding it." I said, "I don't want to go." He goes, "No, I got that part. Just make sure you call me when you're halfway there." So, you know, it was one of those nights in January where the Santa Ana winds were kind of kicking up, and it was kind of a warm evening, you know. And I got on that 91, then I made the transition and got over to the 10, and I'm heading out to 10, you know, and the windows are open, and it's approaching midnight, you know, and I get to the hospital, and it's just pretty quiet, and I start walking into that hospital, and, you know, the automatic doors open, and it's a fairly modern hospital, and the doctor immediately goes, "Are you Ty Arnold?" And I go, "Yes, I am." And she goes, "You know, let me take you over to your dad, you know." And, you know, there's no manual for this. There's no manual for it at all. You know, I was hit with a barrage of questions and stuff like that and decisions I had to make. You know, I held my dad's hand. And he asked me, he says, you know, he goes, "I'm in pretty bad shape, aren't I?" I said, "Well, you know, Dad, it doesn't look good." You know, and my sisters were on the phone, and, you know, we had a hard time with cell reception there. And, I had to make some decisions in the next 14 hours. But, you know, Alcoholics Anonymous is there along with me. And my higher power, which I choose to call God, was right there. You know, I've been impeccable to this man, and I learned it in Alcoholics Anonymous that when he had a stroke a couple years ago, I immediately got on the plane and I came out here and I put my whole life on hold. And I hung out with him 24/7. I'd get there in the morning and I would help feed him, because that's what you told me to do. I would watch television with him when he was kind of coherent, sometimes he wasn't right first after he had the stroke, and then I'd hang out at lunchtime and I would help feed him at lunch, because I wasn't going to let anybody else do it, because they're busy at these places. And then when he took a nap in the afternoon, I'd go to a meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous. And then I'd come back and then finish up the day. And when he was asleep at night, you know, I'd go back to the house and do it all over again. And, you know, when he needed a shower, you know, I got up and helped him. And when he needed changing, I helped him change. And when he needed help in the bathroom, I helped him in the bathroom. Because this is what you told me that we do. This is part of the amends. This is part of giving back. And then when it was time for him to go to a rehabilitation place, you know, I said, I'll be right back. And I drove around that town of Victorville, and I went to every one of them, and I interviewed every owner. And people asked me, what are you doing? I said, well, I'm talking to the owners. Because if my dad's going to go in a place like this, I want to make sure that he has the best. Because I learned it from you. So months later, I'm in the hospital with him. In the wee hours of the morning, he squeezed my hand and he passed into the other room. It was just him and I. That's it. My sisters got there a little later. And I was able to walk through that with dignity. I went back to Los Angeles not too long after that, and I had a lot of friends. And they asked me what happened. I told them my dad passed away. And these are guys I work with, and stuff like that. I've worked with over the course of, 15 years at various times that we worked together. And they asked me, they said, well, when's a funeral? I said, he's a veteran, so, they kind of move at their own pace, and I'll let you know, not really thinking much of it. Text us the information. So, I got the information. It's going to be like 3 weeks or something like that, and I told them what it's going to be. I got up that morning and put a suit on, and I drove off to the cemetery. I met my sisters there, and I was going to be one of the ones that, carries a casket. And I was standing there next to the car, with my sisters and my cousins, and my cousin showed up, yeah. My sponsor showed up, and his wife, Bill C. That was pretty cool. A couple minutes later, a guy named Steve L. showed up. That was pretty cool. And a couple minutes later, these three guys, these three normies, showed up. And I was kind of blown away. So we had the funeral, and we had a little lunch afterwards. So I sat with them, because it's a proper thing, because they don't know people. And we're all sitting there, three of them, myself. And I said to them, guys, I got to admit, I'm kind of a little taken back, a little overwhelmed that you guys showed up. They looked at me like I said something in a foreign tongue. They looked at each other and they said, Ty, do you have any idea what kind of impact you've had on our lives? That's Alcoholics Anonymous. See, what I didn't know is by all these years of working with these gentlemen, I kind of lived by example. And they've had some questionable areas of some of their household members that I've been able to kind of steer them into maybe a solution without being preachy, just by living an example. Has your family tried this and you tried this? And not really thinking much of it. The power of Alcoholics Anonymous just goes on. And I don't always see what kind of result I have in the way I live. But here was a clear example that I could. I'm still pretty blown away, those guys, and they still call me up every once in a while, at least every couple of weeks, and tell me how grateful they are to have me in their life. And These guys are all intents and purposes. This is the normal people you hear about. These are the guys that drink a half a beer and say, "It's time to go to work," you know, or "I got to be somewhere." I can't say enough for Alcoholics Anonymous. I can't say enough for what kind of, you know, life I have today. As you can probably tell, you know, I'm not the most polished, you know, hips looking cool, funny, you know, speaker. But I can tell you from the bottom of my heart, and I hope I did, what happened to me. And this thing we have here. You know, if you're new in Alcoholics Anonymous, and there seems to be a few of them here, you know, I know how you feel. If I haven't told your story, I encourage you to maybe go to another meeting, find somebody that tells your story. I heard my story again and again and again. I heard it just last week by a female, a phenomenal speaker. She told my story. I still go to meetings. I still go to at least 5 a week. I do all the, you know, the hokey things in Alcoholics Anonymous. You know, sometimes we go to meeting, dinner, and a movie. Or we go to dinner, meeting, dinner, and a movie. You know, all these different things on Saturday nights. The conventions. You know, I'm missing the roundup this weekend, but, you know, so be it. The one I'm looking forward to is we have the roundup in South Bay that I try to be a part of, and I hope to see some of you there. I'll be working the registration table. You know, I can't get enough of this thing, and I'm very grateful to all of you, and thank you very much.